The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, the return of club football with all your old favourites. John Terry controversy, injured Robin van Persie, Liverpool in the bottom three, plus new twists like Stoke. Now, long throw-ins and short Owens as Potters attempt to end 10-game victory drought against champions Man City. Elsewhere, we look back at the midweek internationals, disappointments for England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, triumph for Wales, who kept it in single figures against the Serbs and scored a goal. There's David Bentley, Gianni Paladini, hosts and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Right, hello everybody, Football Weekly Extra today with Paul Doyle.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. Michael Hahn, welcome on board.
Hello, James.
And just back from his, your jaunt to Cape Cod, Tom Lutz.
Hello.
In a hat. Nice. And also joining us for this first part, Owen Gibson.
Hi.
Thank you very much for coming by, because first of all, we want to just give a salute to the extraordinary people who yesterday achieved finally an extraordinary thing, the Hillsborough Inquiry Report, which, I mean, you're part of the Guardian team covering it, and there's a lot of great stuff out there, not just on The Guardian, but I've seen some really, really great bits of comment on this. An extraordinary story that we can't really not begin today's show with, because it's rare you see something that I think positions courage and cowardice so starkly in contrast.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was an extraordinary day, actually. It's one of probably the most memorable days I'll probably have as a journalist, in a way, in the, you know, standing yards away from those families who fought for 23 years to get this truth out, and they've finally done it in the shape of this 395-page report. But as you say, I mean, I think a lot of credit has to go to the panel who sort of spent 2.5 years sifting through all these documents.
Almost half a million documents.
That's right, 450,000 pages of documents to get to what we now know to be the truth. And, you know, I mean, one of the striking things about yesterday is that the families knew this all along. A lot of people knew this all along. A lot of it was out there already, and there were so many sort of closed minds who just didn't want to accept it, I think, for such a long time.
It's extraordinary. 23 years, a great triumph in the legal sense for that part of the Hillsborough tragedy, the fact that the blaming and the smearing. But I imagine there must be a lot of bitterness that it's now that you get an apology. It's now 23 years on, four prime ministers
Absolutely.
Later.
And also the fact that I think, you know, the likes of Kelvin McKenzie coming out and apologising, Boris Johnson today coming out and apologising for his Spectator article. I mean, where were these people when, you know, when the Taylor Cate report came out, you know, a matter of months after the disaster, which laid the blame, for, you know, fully at the door of the police? Where were they when Phil Scraton, who wrote this report, wrote his book called The Truth, which laid out much of this in sort of painstaking and heart-rending detail about how, you know, there was clearly a cover up at the heart of this. And the other thing that just strikes you is, you know, kind of just how deeply corrupt the police were in that era. And, you know, and we've seen it across not only this cover up, but others of a similar era, that, you know, kind of just how deeply it went, and how to the lengths they went to look after their own. The establishment went to look after its own. It's, you know, just deeply shocking and moving.
Absolutely. You say a lot of this stuff was out there, but at the same time, yesterday was revelatory in the depth of the cover-up, the extent to which people actively told untruths.
That's
and
right.
The four police officers who, sorry, the four police chiefs who effectively met days after the tragedy to decide on the story, where are they now? Have they not issued any kind of comment?
Well, the chief constable, right, he died last year.
Right.
The various police federation individuals who are named, they haven't spoken yet. I'm sure they'll be sort of tracked down in the coming days if they're still alive. I mean, the thing that shocks you most, as you say, is the little details, almost as much as the big picture and the apologies in Parliament, all the rest of it, and the fact that on the day that Sun's story came out, having been planted by some of these senior police officers and a Tory MP, the day that came out, the Police Federation was meeting in a Sheffield restaurant to sort of with the full knowledge of the chief constable who joined the meeting later, to basically say, you know, we're the accused here, we have to come up with a story and we have to make it stick. And that's what was preoccupying them at a time when, you know, the families of then 95, later 96 people were lying dead, you know.
Extraordinarily, one of the ambulance guys, I think in your piece today, was saying that the police told him not to go on the field because the fans were fighting, yeah. And that other ambulance crews were waiting outside and weren't allowed in because, said the police, the fans were fighting.
I mean, you read the narrative of the day, and it's actually a very well-written report, and it's the level of sort of incompetence is just staggering. I mean, it was sort of an hour before anybody sort of realised the scale of what happened. In the meantime, it was just absolute chaos, and as you say, the prevailing mindset was this is something to be controlled,
yeah,
and contained rather than helped, you know. So and that you know, partly yes, it was a product of the mindset at the time, but also it was just a failure of sort of basic duties in terms of kind of having a major incident plan sticking to it, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if people who've come to football in the last 10, 15 years can actually comprehend how football fans were treated and regarded in the 1980s, because it's that made this possible, that made the cover-up possible. I remember not long after Hillsborough, the When Saturday Comes cover, that week was a picture in the four corners of the cover. There was Graham Kelly, Mrs. Thatcher, the chief of South Yorkshire Police, Anna Terrace, and speech bubbles from each of them. From the first three, it wasn't our fault, and from the fans, oh well, it must be our fault then. And that was the view, that you could treat people like animals. It's not just that, you know, Hillsborough had the conditions that could create that. Stadiums themselves were appalling. Most stadiums were appalling. It was believed that was what was fit for fans. You'd come out of the game off the terraces, and the police would not be there to ensure your safety. They would be there to judge you, regardless of what you'd actually gone to the game for. You were there to be herded without doing any damage. I mean, they were extraordinary times. And it's almost almost impossible to understand that now when you go to a modern stadium.
Country in a way, doesn't it? I mean, that's the other thing that sort of, you know, I was reminded of. I mean, the 80s is obviously an era I grew up in, and you look back at it now and, you know, you just think what a divided country it was, and what a sort of unremittingly grim country it was in some ways, you know. And certainly the experience of football fans was just, as you say, it's kind of almost impossible to comprehend how different it was.
I mean, immediately before Hillsborough, the government had been planning to introduce ID cards for football fans. They thought that football fans needed to carry identity to go to football because they were some kind of separate subspecies.
Mm. And it's interesting that in here, actually, I mean, one of the tiny little details that emerged was that Thatcher, the thing that most concerned Thatcher about the disaster was the effect it was going to have on her chances of getting this bill through Parliament. And again, you know, the sort of the level of self-interest there is extraordinary.
Going forward now, because hopefully this is just the first step, and it's got an unstoppable momentum now, we will see these people who deserved 23 years ago to have answers and also compensation for the incredible legal fight they've had. Is that the next step now, and how soon can we see that?
Well, I think from what we heard yesterday, there should be. I think the inquest will be reopened. It'll be done probably in a matter of weeks. I mean, the Attorney General has to officially do that. He has to strike out the record of accidental death and start a whole new process of inquest, which would mean individual inquests for each of those who died, which is something that a lot of the families have wanted for a long time, but will also obviously be incredibly painful in terms of reliving exactly what happened. I think that will happen in fairly short order. The decisions on whether to launch new criminal actions against corporate bodies. I mean, people mentioned yesterday Sheffield City Council, Sheffield Wednesday Football Club and South Yorkshire Police has been possibly liable for corporate manslaughter charges. Mm. That'll take a much longer sort of 6 to 9 month period, I think, where as they weigh up the amount of time that's passed and the chances of being able to be successful with that prosecution. But yeah, I mean, you're right, this has got a momentum now and it will be seen through because it can't not be.
Mm. Owen, thanks for stopping by and updating us on all of that. Of course, there's plenty more about this, not only on The Guardian's website, but all sorts of other publications as well, and some fascinating, very moving coverage out there. Owen Gibson, anyway, Guardian sports news correspondent.
Must all.
Now, club football returns across Europe this weekend. In the Premier League, leaders Chelsea, who are 3-3, if we don't count that rather embarrassing result in the European Super Cup, visit Loftus Road. Michael Hand's Loftus Road. Now, on the one hand, Michael, 1-0 last season, but on the other, 6-1 last season.
I think the result might well be somewhere in the middle of those two.
You're optimistic.
Well, I think Chelsea should win, realistically, looking at the quality of their side, and also the fact that QPR haven't assembled an entirely new team. Now, hopefully the international break will have done some good and meant they at least know each other, but who knows?
Question at the back. Have they not assembled an entirely new team apart from the rather dodgy ones at the back?
Well, we've got Stefan Mbia, who likes to think of himself as a defensive midfielder, but we think he's going to be a centre-back at Loftus Road. Julio Cesar's got his international clearance.
Yep.
Yeah, Mbia did play, although he does prefer midfield, he has played with success at centre-back for Marseille for the last two seasons, so it's not a completely new position to him.
Oh, no, I understand that, but I think he came talking about his desire to play in defensive midfield, but I don't think anyone at Loftus Road desires to see him fulfil his own desires.
Oh dear. Well, in the back four sense. Anyway, Hazard, Torres, etc. going at a line which conceded five to Swansea. Could get ugly, or could it be another of those jaw-dropping results like that 1-0 win you had last season?
Well, last season, the big thing was genuinely the atmosphere at Loftus Road, which was astonishing. I've not felt anything like that for a number of years. Juan Mata was afraid to take corners. He went over to take the first corner and then ran away, signalling to Frank Lampard to come and do it in his place. Jamie Redknapp, of course, on Sky, said that he likes a good atmosphere, but what those QPR fans did was bang out of order. And it's going to be like that on Saturday as well, I'm sure, especially if John Terry is by any faint chance fit.
Right.
What was the atmosphere like that?
Hang on. Tom, you go first.
Yeah, I was just wondering why it was so fervent last year.
Because QPR despised Chelsea. Chelsea don't despise QPR, which is what QPR fans always forget. So the Chelsea team and fans turned up thinking, here's a little club, we'll play them, it'll be fine. And instead there was what people like to call a seething cauldron of hatred. Last season QPR's programme one game had a special edition to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the 6-0 beating of Chelsea. You know, that's how big Chelsea loom in the QPR mindset.
Wow. Okay, so this is a big game, that's what you're saying.
It's a big game for QPR, not a big game for Chelsea.
Well,
why should it be?
I just think that if Mark Hughes can develop a bit of cohesion in that team, that is still something of a rabble because of the amount of new players being integrated. There are obvious vulnerabilities in Chelsea to be exploited, notably in defence. A defence which, interestingly, this year is getting much less protection from John Mikel Obi, because he suddenly seems to have, as if inspired by the likes of Hazard and Oscar and Mata and all them around him, he suddenly has decided to revert to what he used to be in his teenage years, and this attacking, barnstorming midfielder, and suddenly we've seen him driving forward and dribbling and shooting within 20 yards of goal. It's an all new Mikel at exactly the time that Chelsea don't particularly need him to be doing that.
Because the whole team seems to be more more offensive in some of their cases, would be difficult, but you know what I mean, more attacking.
But yeah. Mikel, who you didn't even expect to figure prominently in the team this season, but if he is going to be in there, you would have thought that he'd be trying to provide a bit of solidity in the middle.
Mm. Michael, you were saying the big thing last year was the atmosphere. Has that extraordinary noise, etc., from the crowd, has that subsided a bit with the disappointing results so far?
Well, to be fair, we've only had the one home game so far, and I have to confess I was in Spain watching on an extremely dodgy stream. But the tail end of last season, the five home games that QPR won in a row, the atmosphere was extraordinary again. And at Loftus Road, it is a very unusual stadium in the Premier League because you are 6 feet away from the players. It does generate a very fervent atmosphere. Not for every game, but it will for Chelsea.
For this one, yes. Okay. Well, as I say, that one's top against very nearly bottom. Very much bottom of the pile are Southampton, who will be at the Emirates taking on Arsenal. They're in a bit of trouble, aren't they, Southampton? But at the same time, no need to panic because it's a rotten set of fixtures they started with, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of two arguments about starting off with very tough games. In one sense, you're getting all the bad stuff out of the way quickly, and hopefully the season will improve from there. But at the same time, psychologically you're starting with heavy defeats, and it's not always a good platform to build from, particularly the way that Southampton were, you know, coming off a successful promotion system, then all of a sudden there's this massive jarring contrast where you're starting to lose. So it's going to be interesting how they kick on from here. It's not really about Arsenal, it's how they do against other clubs such as QPR.
Well, like when they host Wigan at home and lose them. Yeah, that is a bit concerning.
That's kind of what decides the season.
One of the points of received wisdom so far appears to be that Southampton will have nothing to worry about because despite losing, they've played well against big teams. But I'm not sure I trust that because we've all seen underdogs raise their game massively against fantastic teams and then slump back when they're back to playing the run-of-the-mill Premier League team. So I don't think actually the performances against City and United are a reliable measure.
Plus the big question mark over Southampton coming into the season, because everyone knew that they'd be able to score goals and that Ricky Lambert is a Premier League player, for example, and they've signed other guys like Ramirez, etc. But the big question mark over them was their ability to keep clean sheets, which they haven't been able to do yet this
season. Eight conceded so far. Are Arsenal the kind of team that other clubs raise their game for?
I think
okay.
so, yeah.
Good, right. Diaby, he's gone out injured. Is it serious, Paul?
Apparently it's not that serious. Oh, okay. Whether it's serious enough to rule him out this weekend, I don't know.
Right. All right, then. Good. Well, there you go. Arsenal coming off a terrific win against Liverpool at Anfield last time, while Liverpool are indeed making their way to Sunderland. If they lose this, it'll be the worst Liverpool start in 104 years. 104 years. That's bad in anyone's language, Paul.
Can't argue with that, yeah. They've been on a steady slide in recent seasons, and Brendan Rodgers can't be expected to reverse that in just a couple of months. I will be interested to see how he does attempt to reverse it. Obviously, we know the style that he's trying to inculcate there. But I'd like to see, he's mentioned, for example, the possibility of deploying Stuart Downing at left back. And that is, of course, an acknowledgement of Stuart Downing's ineffectiveness as a winger. But also, I think, of the deterioration of Jose Enrique's performances since he's gone to Liverpool. He's been playing very badly for a long time. And that has been a problem position for Liverpool in recent decades. With the exception of John Arnorisa, who did a reasonably good job there. If you look at some of the names they've had there over the years, it's quite a roll of shame. With Jimmy Traore, Diggy Ingi, Bjornaby, Julian Dix, Paul Konchesky, Josimi, Kromkamp.
Do you think
Ziga.
That
brings a laugh to the face?
Do you think that's genuine, Stuart Downing? You could be a left back, or is he saying, talk to your agent and be out of here in January?
A lot of people would say left back in the dressing room.
Whoa.
Funny people.
Well, I certainly don't think he'd object to selling him. As we know, he'd sell most of that squad, such as his need for money and replacements. But I do think left back is a problem area, and if there's potential for Downing to solve it, it's worth a try, because Enrique is so bad there at the moment.
Well, we know that Downing can't really cross, and it's probable that he can't tackle. So that's kind of two things a fullback should be able to do.
Enrique doesn't do it with great regularity.
Yeah.
We've been talking about Liverpool for a bit. We haven't mentioned Raheem Sterling again yet. So here's a quick tweet from someone. Kai Schindelmeier: is Sterling a future star or another Walcott? It's a bit harsh on Theo, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is a bit harsh on
Theo. Juve target Theo Walcott. What do you think? Raheem, real deal?
Yeah, I think, judging by the little I've seen of him so far, I think he has more skill, more tricks than Walcott has ever had. He's got a pleasing directness and he looks good, but he's only 17, so he could go either way.
He
could go the David Bentley way, or he could go the Walcott way. Walcott's had a very respectable career so far, hasn't he?
He certainly has. Respectable, David Bentley, interesting you mentioned him. Because he's just signed for, is it SC Rostov?
Rostov, I believe, yeah.
FC Rostov. Now, I must have missed a few episodes in the Bentley career trajectory. How did this happen? Anybody? No?
He blames it all on the fact that he tipped water over Harry Redknapp's head when they qualified for the Champions League. So that had him branded as a troublemaker.
Right.
And after that, Harry didn't want to have anything to do with him. Not that Harry wanted that much to do with him before either, despite paying 15 million quid for him.
Yeah.
But then, to be fair, Spurs books have not been short of players Harry paid a lot of money for and then completely forgot about. It's just he's the single biggest outlay.
But Bentley, when he was back at Blackburn and they were getting into Europe and all that sort of thing, looked astonishing, no?
He was good at Blackburn, but he says he's got a false reputation among managers in the Premier League that he's,
for being
as Michael
good
said, some kind of, no, well, yeah, quite, some kind of troublemaker. And you possibly, if that's just with one manager like Redknapp,
yeah,
there might be some truth to it. But the fact that nearly every manager who's managed him seems to have come up with this opinion.
Well, what's your opinion? Was he not at Birmingham?
He was at Birmingham, and like a lot of his clubs, he was good at the start. But right, once he'd proved himself or, you know, shown what he could do, he just took his foot off the pedal. I remember when he scored his first goal for Arsenal when he was a kid, and actually thinking that day, I'll always remember David Bentley's first goal, which I have, but obviously he just never kicked on from that. And it seems to be a pattern with him. He'll do very well at the start of a career at the club and then just fade away.
All right, so money on FC Rostov for these early fixtures.
Yeah.
He's 28. He played just 42 times for Spurs in 4 years. He was the first player to score at the new Wembley in 2007. Of course, he famously turned down an England call-up because he wanted to go on holiday and stuff. And I think, yeah, a bit of alarm bells might have been ringing there. Some say he's been more interested in the Buddha Beach Boutique Beach Club he owns in Marbella. That sounds nice, doesn't it?
Mm.
Who wouldn't be? Who wouldn't be? Anyway, so he won't be involved in this particular game, clearly. Sunderland, though, they've got all sorts of exciting new players to throw at this game, although I believe Adam Johnson won't be fit for the match. But Stephen Fletcher, hey, 12 million, a bargain, a snip. Is this Sunderland's game for the taking, do you think, Paul?
It's a difficult one to call. There's every chance of them winning it. And Stephen Fletcher is a good player.
Right.
And with Martin O'Neill's penchant for getting crosses into the box, Fletcher is possibly one of the best headers of the ball in the league.
Oh, okay.
Despite being not a particularly physically fearsome character.
Hmm.
Yeah, every chance of them causing Liverpool problems.
All right, yeah. Okay. Beach balls. We haven't mentioned beach balls. There you go. No, I can't think of anything fresh or clever to say about Beach Ball. So, no, I think that's a very difficult fixture, that, for Liverpool. Man United, hey, they're taking on the Wigan team that derailed their title bid last season. You remember? April?
Yeah. Brilliant game.
All right, Tom. Will it be similarly brilliant this time around?
Well, Van Persie's a doubt.
Mm.
And Kagawa
is as well.
And he
got United out of jail last time, didn't he? And the time before.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Not the time before that, because he wasn't playing for them.
Yeah.
But, he was... It's Old Trafford, isn't it? I think if it was at Wigan, it would be a little bit more dodgy with Van Persie and Kagawa possibly out. But
Kagawa also an injury fear.
Through international. I think they're playing Iraq or something like that. And another thing is it's Rio's 400th appearance for United.
If he was going to appear?
Yeah.
Is he not another injury doubt?
I don't think so.
Usually is.
Mm. All right.
But to be fair to United's attack, Danny Welbeck on Tuesday night was one of the few people who played with any urgency for England. So it's not like even with Van Persie and Rooney absent, United have absolutely no one who can play up front.
Mm. Although they haven't got anyone who's scored 5 goals in the last 8 games like Franco Di Santo has. Have some of that. And what about Aruna Kone?
They still don't have anyone who can consistently unlock defences. They still have a creativity deficit in central midfield. Paul Scholes resolved that when he came on against Southampton. But he's not going to do it.
Did you not get the Tom Cleverley memo?
Who's he again? The new Paul Scholes?
The new Paul Scholes.
Right. Not convinced.
Is he fit this weekend, Tom Cleverley?
I believe so.
All right. Anyway, it doesn't sound like we're predicting another Wigan upset here.
I think United will take it.
United to take it, there you go. Who'll be in goal? Will it be De Gea? Again, will he be back after the little Lindegaard parenthesis?
Right. Isn't that a Robert Ludlum?
I was just going to say it. It sounds... Yeah. Right. While they're doing that, their chum City... Now, this is an exciting game. Who wants to talk about Stoke Man City first?
It could be Michael Owen's...
Exactly.
...debut.
It's so exciting. It won't be there, will it? He'll have... Walters up front, presumably.
Well, he's definitely rested because he hasn't really
played that much. 10 games without a win, Stoke. This would be a great time to spring a victory, wouldn't it?
It's a great time to play Stoke as well, because that means that within the space of 3 days you can do the complete football spectrum. Stoke at the Britannia to Real Madrid at the Bernabeu.
All right, then. Stoke held Arsenal at the Britannia, didn't they? 0-0. Yeah. Yeah.
They raised their game.
They raised their game, didn't they? And they'll surely raise it for Man City. Owen, yeah, with Crouch, terrific record for England.
Some years ago.
Yeah, but, you know.
Pelé and Jairzinho had a terrific record for Brazil, but I wouldn't fancy them anymore against Stoke.
It's a fair point you make, Michael. All right, then. I was just getting excited about, you know, them rolling back the years, getting the band back together. and all that.
Well, it's quite surprising that he's still only 32, seeing as he there seems to have been around for ages. And I kind of read an interview with him today, and he was saying, I'm still only 32. And I was like, oh, he's only 32. I think he's about 35 or 36.
What else did he say in his interview?
He said that he was looking forward to the game and he was going to take each game as it came.
Right. Sensible words, yeah. I think.
Did he say it was always a dream to play for Stoke?
Yeah, I think that was included in there as well.
Right. Well, is he on some kind of very, very funny contract?
he's on a low basic with assorted bonuses if he manages to get to the stadium with everything intact.
And 300 free minutes if he tops up in the first month or something like that.
The Kieran Dyer deal, as we call it.
Okay. He was on Celebrity Mr. and Mrs. this week as well.
I'm sorry, what?
He was on Celebrity Mr. and Mrs.
But he only lasted 18 minutes.
Well, actually, he did, even though he's been with his wife since...
Hang on. Okay, Mr. and Mrs. is the game show whereby one partner goes into a soundproof booth, and in many marriage cases, presumably wants to stay there.
Yes.
So they can't hear what their partner's saying, and then they have to come up and respond to the same questions. I love that game.
Well, Michael Owen plays it as well. He's a fan as well, yeah.
That's fantastic. Mrs. Owen was there.
Yeah.
I didn't even know he was married, actually. What was she like? He's got four kids, just in.
They've been together since... Well, John Ashdown says they've been together since nursery school, but despite that, they didn't seem to know much about each other.
Right.
Which was disturbing.
Well, maybe it's the mystery that keeps the flame alive in the Owen household. So what was she like? Describe her, Tom.
She looks a little bit like Jessica Ennis. That's
right. Okay.
But I mean, she seemed a perfectly decent person. Yeah, she didn't swear or anything like that.
No. Okay.
But she doesn't know much about Michael Owen. So
okay,
it's a mystery, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, didn't she read the brochure?
Yeah.
So wow, that's amazing. So who did win then on Celebrity Mr. and Mrs.? Who else was on?
Do you know what? I didn't stay to the end.
All right. Time's running away from us once again, so let me just pile through some of the other fixtures this weekend. Raise a hand or make an excited noise if there's something you wanted to throw in here. Aston Villa, Swansea, anybody? Norwich, West Ham?
Just an interesting one for stats fans.
All right.
West Ham have perpetrated more fouls than any other team in the Premier League so far, and Norwich haven't had a single yellow card in the entire season.
It's a battle of the lightness.
Despite having Grant Holt on their team.
Is Andy Carroll back for this game?
Well, no, he's just gone out, hasn't he? He's only just gone out injured.
Well, he was out. That was 10 days ago now.
No, I thought he was out for... He's got a hamstring.
How long is he out for?
I think... Yeah, I think maybe even 6 weeks.
Blimey.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of an issue, but they go... Carlton Cole will be playing the Andy Carroll role, I imagine.
But not as well as Andy Carroll does it.
Well, it is the Andy Carroll role. That's why they call it that. Good. Everton Newcastle. That's a big game, isn't it? Be some answers for questions after that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting to see how Fellaini plays in that match. Because, of course, he started the season very well. But I note that Belgium rested him during the week because they said he was tired.
Right. That's interesting. Because he had a shocker.
That was in their 1-1 draw with Croatia.
Yeah.
And another feature of that game, similar to the match against Wales, Belgium missed lots of chances. Despite introducing a new striker, they replaced Morales, the Everton player, with Christian Benteke, who was just signed for Aston Villa. Ooh. And may well feature this weekend against Swansea, because although Paul Lambert is trying to cultivate a more passing style at Aston Villa, you'd imagine that Swansea are much better at them than them. And they've had difficulty, despite their decent showing at Newcastle in the previous two matches, they had real difficulty getting the ball to Darren Bent. So Benteke is much more of a big target man who you can try an alternative approach to, or you just launch it to him long. But he's not a great finisher, nor particularly technically adept, as Belgium found out to their cost again against Croatia.
That's interesting. So it would be two up front with Darren Bent and...
Well, possibly. I imagine the reason that Benteke was bought was to give this other option. And he, given how the season has started for them, you try it as soon as possible.
So they have Bent and Bentaka. That's interesting. I like it when you've got a double. In the Roma lineup at the moment, they have Marquinho and Marquinhos, and they're not related at all.
Well, they've got different surnames, haven't they?
They have, effectively. Different and yet very, very, very similar surnames. Okay. Ooh, how about Reading Spurs? Spurs still looking for their first win. Do you know, Reading, they won't have played a Premier League game for 3.5 weeks by the time this game kicks off. And would you fancy Spurs, even there at the Medeski Stadium, with Dembele making his first start potentially, with Adebayor now fit?
Yeah, on paper, and yes, Chelsea. They should. But it's been a curious start to the season for Spurs. I mean, AVB has come in for a lot of premature criticism, I think. It's far too early to be getting on his back about some things, particularly the Hugo Lloris thing, which in my opinion is handled perfectly fairly so far. But the worrying thing about their performances in particular is just how cautious and lethargic they've looked.
Spurs. But
yeah, particularly in the home match against Norwich. I mean, things that were taken as a given under Redknapp and at Spurs traditionally, with the fullbacks bombing on, the wingers bombing on, they were really hesitant. And the likes of Kyle Walker and even Aaron Lennon against Norwich, they'd get the ball, they'd stop, they'd look around, and they'd knock it sideways quite often.
Is this because they're struggling with the new managerial instructions or what?
It's hard to know if they're confused by the instructions or if AVB, being wounded by his time at Chelsea, has become a little bit more cautious. He said no when asked about that afterwards. He said they're just a little bit anxious because it's been a bad start to the season and we'll get up and running very quickly, especially when the likes of Dembele start, Clint Dempsey comes in probably, and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how they evolve, because it was the most un-Spurs-like performance, it looked more like a team playing at the end of a managerial regime.
Then
at the start when they're all trying to impress and look good.
Right.
It was a really strange performance.
Well, you do wonder, because there is already a quite clear atmosphere among the press of picking up on anything they can. There doesn't seem to be any benefit of the doubt for Andre Villas-Boas. You wonder if, to what extent that emanates from the club or emanates or dissipates into it, if that's the right
way. Well, once a narrative is decided, it gets very hard to get out of it. And the Andre Villas-Boas narrative was decided at Chelsea. And it would have taken thrashings of the opposition in the opening Spurs game to have altered that in any meaningful sense. And the fact that he has had a poor start means that he's kind of condemned. He does need some sort of miracles to get the world on his side. But, I mean, he's clearly a talented coach. I mean, you don't do as well as he did at Porto without having talent. There's no doubt about that. But the changing things so quickly at Spurs, I mean, of course, that's his job, to change things quickly. But I'm inclined to believe that the players are just finding it difficult to adjust as yet.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of change at Spurs that was inevitable, and that he had to be changed quickly, more so than at Chelsea.
Hope no one throws a bottle of water over his head. That can't see that finishing well. Just quickly then, to finish off our weekend roundup, Fulham West Brom. Hey, Fulham have signed Georgios Katagounis. He of the composed goal celebration in Euro 2012.
Yeah, we get excited about well-known players coming to England, but it's also exciting when players that you didn't know about come and do really well. And West Brom have a prime example of that in Claudio Jacobs, the Argentinian central midfielder who's played an important role in them being so impressive this season, both shielding the defence and being quite nifty in his passing. And West Ham have been really good to watch.
I feel so superficial.
Did I say West Brom or West Ham there?
No, whichever. You meant West Brom.
That's certainly who I meant.
All right.
Because West Ham aren't good to watch.
Right, and here's me banging on about Karagounis. That's yesterday news. Good, nice one, Paul. Thank you very much. Well, more fun and games in a second or two when we look at post and international action. In other celebrity Mr. and Mrs. news, Michael Owen was joined by Rachel Stevens. Stevens, out of S Club 7, and her lucky husband, Alex. You didn't see it? I can't believe you switched off before she came on.
I always switch off when Rachel Stevens comes.
Really?
Yeah, she's the reason behind S Club 7 splitting up.
So. Okay. She's the Yoko Ono.
Destroyed
the whole
my heart, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, then. Now, there's been a lot of international action. Too much international action, some people would say. For example, Jamie Garwood, who says, how would you change qualifying process for the World Cup Euros as it seems inferior / stagnant to CONCACAF version? I get this. We did touch on this the other day, actually. There's all these qualifying groups. It's a bit too much, Michael, would you say? When you're playing all these...
You've got that many countries. You've got to allow them all the chance to qualify, haven't you?
Yeah, but do you... Do you have them all qualifying with everybody else at the same time? Wouldn't it be handier if you have, like, the South American League, where they all play each other and it's a bit more straightforward?
Well, how many countries are there in Europe? You'd have to have two or three divisions, in effect,
right,
wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And you've still got the... Couldn't you just have pre-qualifying
like you have in Europa League and Champions League?
So you're arguing for making it less complicated by having pre-qualifying.
I'm thinking they have a pre-qualifying, then they go into a little group, and then the winners of that group go through to something else. I'm not sure.
I like the fact that the big boys have to fraternise with the little guys.
Right, okay.
I don't know, it's just twice in a period of 2 years.
It's tough, though, when you're facing... I don't know, like this week at Wembley, you're facing an unglamorous team who... You knew who their big striker was, but he's not there anymore. But enough about England, Budumtich. Ukraine handled it pretty well, I thought. What did you make of this game, Paul? You might have been watching Ireland-Oman over at Fulham, the most pointless friendly in the history of pointless friendlies, as one listener called it.
So pointless that I didn't watch it.
Michael, I know you went to Wembley.
I went to Wembley.
All right, what did you think?
I thought it was dreadful.
Really?
Yeah, England, well...
Oh, come on, Defoe's goal was a screamer. He thraked it.
But then he viciously attacked the Ukraine defender to put it in, didn't he?
Yeah.
No, England looked sluggish and lethargic. I thought so, yeah.
But think of all the players they're missing, Michael. Think of them.
Am I meant to say how the players who didn't play would have performed or how the players who did play performed?
It wasn't Roy's first choice team, surely.
It wasn't Roy's first choice team, but nevertheless, that doesn't mean the team played well. You know, they didn't play especially well. I think Roy was dissembling a bit afterwards when he said that they controlled the game apart from the first 10 minutes. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of game to control, really.
Right.
It was the mood at Wembley was not full of joy and happiness at seeing this England team.
Yeah, why is that? A lot of people commenting on the come down after the buzz around the Olympics.
I don't think it's to do with the Olympics. I just think that the English team was no fun to watch.
All right, then. Well, they knew what they were getting into. They bought tickets for England. What did they expect, these people?
Yeah, well, it's that kind of grim sense of duty and loyalty that people have, isn't it?
Right. Johnny Late says, I'm sure the pod will enjoy themselves at England's expense. A rare thing for... But a word for the Ukrainian performance is due. They were good, no?
Yeah. No, fantastic goal.
Yeah. Phew, that goal, eh?
Better than Jermaine Defoe's.
Yeah.
Non-goal.
Right, okay. What was his name again, the fellow? Yevhen Konoplyanka.
I don't think that's the correct pronunciation.
Well, that's what it says here on my piece of paper. But it was a good goal anyway, in any language.
Yeah.
Right. Speaking of funny names, says producer Ben, what was the referee called? Do you know this one?
No.
Kakir.
Huh?
Kakir.
Was his name Kakir?
You're talking about his first name, isn't it? Which has the letter C-U-N-T featuring prominently in it.
No. Now that's funny. All right, let's move on.
Good.
Right. In other international news, Spain only got a 1-0 win away in Georgia. Germany scraped past Austria away 2-1. Italy only managed two goals at home to Malta. It's a bit rubbish. While Netherlands under Van Gaal, remember how everyone said that wasn't going to work out? My word, they're in flying form. They had a 4-1 victory over Hungary with Robin van Persie limping off at halftime, I believe. Anyway.
And Switzerland went marching on.
Yeah, you're Switzerland. Come on, Paul, tell us about it.
Well, they're top of their group, 2 wins out of 2, no goals conceded. Exciting young thrusters like Shaqiri and Haka and Derdiot all doing their thing. They're a rising force.
All right, then. Now, in other home nations news, not one of the home nations. Ireland got a win against Oman?
4-1.
4-1, all right. But that was only in a friendly. All the home nations that were in qualifying, not a single 1-1. We talked about England. Right. Serbia
looked absolutely magnificent against Wales. I'm not sure to
6-1.
What
6-1?
Yeah, 6-1, and it could have been twice that.
Wow.
For Serbia, at least.
Right.
They're passing, they're dribbling, lovely little 1-2s, cutting Wales apart with a little bit of help from the Welsh, who seemed dazed throughout.
Criminal. That's how their own manager described them, criminal.
Well,
you can't say anything.
Can't take
he is no, their manager, though, so he's partly responsible for them being rubbish.
Right.
And it's five defeats now.
I mean, Wales were starting to look really good under Gary Speed.
Right.
And now they look really bad.
Yeah. I think Chris Coleman's got progressively worse each club he's managed.
Yeah.
Like, he's just got worse and worse and worse.
Ooh.
Is he
Bentley, managerially speaking?
He should manage FC Rostov and see what he can get out of
a perfect
Bentley.
Storm of, of deteriorating form. Okay.
In slight mitigation, though, now, being a small country, you always suffer when some key players are missing because of their limited
What's the population of Serbia and what's the population of Wales?
Uh, don't know either of those.
Okay,
but
right.
I do know that Wales have severely missed the likes of James Collins and Craig Bellamy and people like that.
The good news for Wales is that next they play Scotland.
Yeah. Mm. Well, talking about population, Scotland is about 5.5 million. I guess when you include people of Scottish descent can qualify through grandparents and stuff like that, including me, you've probably got 8 million. So it's not a massive country in terms of population. So they shouldn't be expected to qualify for every major tournament. But I think the problem with them at the moment is just the performances you're seeing from them under Levine are so uninspiring. And you almost don't mind if your side's losing as long as, A, they're making progress, or B, at least playing slightly entertaining football. But he just seems to have lost all the fans. The, by all accounts, the atmosphere's been terrible at home games. I just think that's what Scottish fans are disappointed about. It's just the quality of the football. It's kind of even worse than under McLeish, who at least beat sides like France.
Hey, Craig Levine must regret that hostage to fortune last week as well, where he said that Scotland could beat and could win every game in this group. The minute you said that, you thought, well, you know, theoretically, if you had some different players, different manager, and a much greater population, you might be able to. But with what you got, sorry.
Wonk says, looking forward to the Wales-Scotland game. Do you think they'll bother with a ball or just run around shrieking and waving their hands in the air? Wonk, that's kind of borderline. That's just abuse.
Why did you read it then?
Well, he needs to have a think about himself, really. More post fun. His misery, late and probably rubbish, but anyway, he says, Alan, recherche de temps perdu. Because we were talking about, you know, melancholy player names and that. Also, somebody was asking you about TP Mazembe, Paul Doyle. Why? They just said TP Mazembe, international launch or something.
I'm not too sure why they wanted to know today in particular.
No.
Possibly because TP Mazembe are playing Chelsea this weekend. But that's Berekum Chelsea, the Ghanaian in their final African Champions League group game. They're already guaranteed a place in the semi-finals. This will determine who their opponents are. And, of course, whoever wins the African Champions League this year will end up facing possibly the real Chelsea in the FIFA Club World Championship.
Thing. Yeah. Super. Did you want to add anything else about them?
Well, I don't know what the guy wanted to know. So
all right. Perhaps if you'd like to tweet again and make your inquiry more specific. Tom, let's just ask you something finally. When did you and Michael Hamm? Because I do read reports that Jenny Palladini... You won't remember him, Michael.
I do remember him.
He had a brief foray into West London football.
He did.
Not so long ago. He's launching a takeover bid now for Birmingham. And has he also... Scotch reports that Flavio Briatore might be involved in this as well.
I never want to read reports about Flavio Briatore again as long as
unless
I live.
Unless they contain the words, etc.
Well. Now, Gianni Palladini, when he came in at QPR, he did do some good. I mean, we got very, 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 very fed up of him. But at first, you know, he did do a lot for the club in terms of keeping it afloat at a very desperate time. There's also the chance that he might behave a bit more sensibly at Birmingham, because QPR were at the absolute lowest ebb. There was very little identity around the club. And clearly he and then later Briatore and Eccleston thought, there's nothing. It's a vacuum here. We can do what we want with this, which I don't think is the case at Birmingham, where life might be made a bit more tricky for them if they come in a very high-handed fashion.
Right. Birmingham fans like Tom Lutz just won't accept that kind of thing.
Well, I think anybody is better than someone who can't leave their own country because of
house arrest or
right.
So he certainly came out smelling of roses in that excellent 5-year plan documentary.
Four-year plan. Good fact checking. No, I mean, the measure of how the esteemed Palladini was held at Loftus Road was that when QPR won promotion, when the trophy was paraded around Loftus Road and Palladini came to lift it up, and he got booed by the whole ground. Oh. On an occasion when no one did anything but cheer, he got booed.
Right. There you go.
He's lived in Solihull for many, many years, so he has at least got some kind of...
Hey?
Yeah, it's true.
Really?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Didn't his wife get attacked in Solihull a couple of years ago as well?
Oh, yeah, maybe he's not the best person to take over. But anyway, he has got links with Birmingham. And one of his credentials he was going on about the other day when he was talking about possible move to Birmingham was that he knows lots of the Zulus, which are people that don't know, are the hooligans. So he seems to think that that's a positive.
All right, what kind of place is Solihull, Tom?
Posh.
They have a John Lewis, don't they?
I believe they. I think I've been to the John Lewis.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Thank goodness you're here.
Well, you've been to so many John Lewis's. Yeah. Every town, you look for a John Lewis.
Yeah. All right. So, but there you go. If he does it, is it better him than nothing? Or
yeah, it's better than the current regime.
Well, as you say, yeah.
Be careful what you wish for, Tom.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is it for today's Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks then to Paul Doyle, to Owen Gibson, who stopped by earlier on, Michael Han, and of course Tom Lutz and producer Ben. We'll be back on Monday reviewing all the weekend action. Speak to you then.